From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In a conversation years ago with Utah's former poet laureate Catherine Coles, Mark Strand said that poetry can be the most profound reading experience that we'll have if we're willing to give it its due. Strand was one of the country's most acclaimed poets. He died over the weekend. And he said we live in an impatient culture, but that poetry almost never gives instant gratification. It takes time to work out how the form works with the content, and it's only until you work out the puzzle that it comes to you. When I go to the races, Strand said, the longer the race, the more interesting. But people today are much more interested in a dash. Today in the program, we're going to rebroadcast our conversation with Mark Strand from 2007. It was a show about an extraordinary life committed to language and art and patience. After the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's not easy talking to a poet about poetry, let alone one of the world's truly great poets like Mark Strand. It's because poems are a different kind of narrative than a novel or a short story, and that's obvious enough. Strand himself has said that a poem is more demanding than prose. The medium is more dense, and so every word carries weight that it doesn't have in other disciplines. So there's more to all of this than just explaining what a poem means. Poetry, Strand said, requires a kind of patience. Mark Strand died over the weekend, and today in the program we're going to take an opportunity to rebroadcast a conversation we had with him back in 2007. We talked about the terrain of poetry that he's explored all his life.
I want to begin, if we could, by talking about poetry, because there are times when I'm doing interviews where I will, ask a musician or ask an artist or novelist, to read a passage and then talk about where it came from, what it means to them, the sort of process of going through it. Do you think it's trickier with poetry to do that than to sort of extract a poem and say, this is what I was thinking about and this is what it means?
Well, it is difficult because very often, most often, you don't know where the idea comes from.
Yeah.
And what you happen to be doing when you get the idea is irrelevant. The poem itself is a search for what it is that you want to say. I mean, it's not that you get an idea for a poem. You have a mild sense of urgency, a desire to sit down and write, and maybe a phrase will be in your mind or a word. And then you add a word or another phrase, and gradually you build up a few lines, and you try to find out what's in there that can generate more. And so a poem is built up gradually. Of course, there are times when a poem comes to you in its entirety, but those times are relatively rare. It's happened to me only a few times. And mainly it's just figuring out what it is that you want to say and what it was about that first prompting that made you want to continue.
He said somewhere once that the thing that gives rise to the poem oftentimes sort of dissolves into the background.
It does. I mean, you may have a line come to you, and that may get you started, but in the course of writing the poem, that line may disappear. And you may have a few lines that you like in a poem, and they may be the very thing, the best lines in the poem may be the very lines that ruin the poem.
Yeah.
So you have to take them out and maybe use them in another poem where they could function better and perhaps in a more appropriate way.
Do you think that some of us think about poetry in the wrong way? That is, a lot of time it's trying to extract meaning from a book. You know, this metaphor somehow has some kind of meaning, and that poetry isn't as, I won't say as accessible, but it doesn't have as linear sort of a, you know, a meaning, I guess, if there's any other, there must be a better word than
well,
that.
Well, it can. I mean, some poems you read and you exhaust them in a single reading.
Yeah.
And you know exactly what's been said. But those are the poems that don't have much weight. I think a poem is a demands more, really. It's like anything that is important. It demands investigation and consideration. And a poem has many levels, or many poems have many levels. And what you thought a poem meant on first reading may be altered on the second reading, and yet again on a third reading. And each time, with each successive reading, you feel another part of yourself coming into play. And you discover things about yourself in the reading of poems. I mean, poems do reach parts of a reader that, you know, other kinds of writing don't. I think they're more concentrated. They're based largely on emotions that are somewhat inchoate and need shaping, and finally find their form in a poem so that feeling can be communicated beyond simply a grunt or a word like wow,
yeah,
or gee whiz. Because, you know, our responses are really quite subtle. Our responses to one another, our responses to the world are really quite subtle and demand considered language to be well represented.
Someone, you've been here for a day or so, and last night at a gathering, as I understand it, somebody asked whether or not your poems were surreal. And you prefer the word fantastic.
Yeah, because surreal is too... Surrealism was a movement of the 20s and 30s that had political and social overtones. And it became a style. And, you know... There's a some overlapping with the fantastic, but I think fantastic art bears the character of the individual artist more emphatically, and it's not fantastic art isn't created against a norm. It really speaks for the deviance of a single individual, or the way that individual sees the world, without the intervention of or the consideration of a social or political end.
Mm. I want to have you read, if you would, Man and Camel.
Yeah, I'll read it and answer questions about it.
This is it sort of falls into that realm. I mean, not any, maybe more than others, but that notion of fantastic, I guess.
Yeah, well, I like making things up.
Yeah.
And making things up is something I think I'm good at, and it gives me pleasure. Man and Camel. On the eve of my 40th birthday, I sat on the porch having a smoke, when out of the blue a man and a camel happened by. Neither uttered a sound at first, but as they drifted up the street and out of town, the two of them began to sing. Yet what they sang is still a mystery to me. The words were indistinct and the tune too ornamental to recall. Into the desert they went, and as they went, their voices rose as one above the sifting sound of wind-blown sand. The wonder of their singing. Its elusive blend of man and camel seemed an ideal image for all uncommon couples. Was this the night that I had waited for so long? I wanted to believe it was. But just as they were vanishing, the man and camel ceased to sing and galloped back to town. They stood before my porch, staring up at me with beady eyes, and said, "You ruined it. You ruined it forever."
Did it begin, this poem, with an image? Did it begin?
It began with an image of a man and a camel.
Yeah.
Just simply in a blank space, in a desert. And there wasn't a 40th birthday. That's made up. Sure. I just like the sound of 40th against the word porch in the next line. And I put the porch there, and I gradually, I mean, the poem went through many drafts. I didn't know really where the poem was headed. And I finally realized that I'd done something in the poem that one shouldn't do, which is to say what the poem meant, or that is interpreting the role of the man and the camel. And that's why the man and the camel turn around at the end of the poem and accuse me of having ruined it, having ruined it forever. It's the poem turning against the poet, saying, "You stepped out of line here when you said, you know, the wonder of their singing, its elusive blend of man and camel seemed an ideal image for all uncommon couples."
You're breaking the fourth wall there then in some ways, aren't you? I'm referring to it.
I'm telling them what they mean.
Yeah.
I'm putting them in a rather narrow category. Instead of just letting the absurd vision of a man and a camel sort of be, I felt I had to do something to it.
But as opposed to fix it, you let it go. You and it's almost as if that there was that acknowledgement there of breaking that spell of all poetry.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an odd poem in that it has its say, and then it says, "Well, you made a mistake." I mean, it's a poem which the criticism of itself is part of the poem.
Yeah, yeah. There's another piece that I wanted you to read. This is it's a funny piece, I guess. I don't. Is it whimsical? It's called Elevator.
Oh yeah.
Talk about this.
Okay, I think I should read it first.
Of course.
And then say, Elevator is a poem in two parts. Part one. The elevator went to the basement. The doors opened. A man stepped in and asked if I was going up. "I'm going down," I said. "I won't be going up." Two. The elevator went to the basement. The doors opened. A man stepped in and asked if I was going up. "I'm going down," I said. "I won't be going up." Well, you know, I wrote part one right away. I looked at it, and I started writing it again, thinking I would make some changes, because I often have to, when I rewrite, have to, well, actually write what I'd written again and then add to it. So as I was writing the second part, I wasn't able to think of any changes. So I had written two identical three-line stanzas. And then I thought, you know, I'm going to leave it this way, because if I've read the first part and then read the second part, it won't be heard the same way, because the listener will be waiting for a change that doesn't occur.
Yeah.
they'll be waiting for some sort of difference, and it will create a degree of anxiety in the reader, I mean in the listener. The listener might even think, gee, is Strand drunk? He's read the same thing twice, you know? So it would be, even though the two sections are identical, they're not heard the same way. So in fact, although they look identical, they're quite different.
Yeah. So do you think of, do you conceive of poems as not just things on a page, but the way they, the sort of the cadence of them, the way they sound?
Oh, I do. I say them aloud to myself again and again as I'm writing, and it's really the cadence that concerns me most. I believe that meaning takes care of itself. I mean, I think if I worried about meaning, I wouldn't be writing poems. I'd be writing something else. I mean, I don't want to say that poems are devoid of meaning. They are, but unless there's a cadence, unless they have a seductive surface, a way of enchanting the hearer or the reader, no point in writing them.
Mark Strand, do you remember the first poem that meant something to you?
By somebody else?
Yeah, by somebody else.
Yeah, it was you, Andrew Marvel. And I wrote about it, an essay. I was a teenager and, you know, feeling the kind of dissatisfaction and alienation that teenagers feel. And this was a poem that spoke directly to that, to my apartness, my feelings of apartness, and spoke to my sort of even then commitment to solitude and my burgeoning awareness of my own mortality. And, you know, I was really the figure in that poem of Archibald MacLeish's. And that led to other poems. But I didn't write poems at that age. I was just moved by them. But I felt that the writing of poems was beyond me. Perhaps I had respect for poems. I mean, when you're a big, I was smart enough to know that whatever I'd write would be lousy, you know. And I wanted to like my poems the way I liked other people's poems.
I want to have you read, because I want to talk about your first collection, Sleeping with One Eye Open.
Yeah.
And there's a poem in here, actually. I'm going to sort of shift gears a bit, but Keeping Things Whole.
Oh, yes.
Which I wonder if you, I guess on one hand, I'm wondering if that does sort of help understand, because this is a poem that people talk about a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how you feel about that poem these days.
Well, you know, I certainly don't reject it.
Yeah.
I certainly recognize it as a poem of mine, but it took me about 20 seconds to write.
Wow.
Whereas other poems of mine, I've labored over for months, and I have a much greater commitment to them. You know, they feel like a much greater part of me. But this is a key poem in that it speaks for a point of view that has been continuous in my work. A sense that the world could get along very well without me, and by extension, could get along very well without people.
Yeah.
And that consciousness represents an unwanted intervention, keeping things whole. In a field, I am the absence of field. This is always the case, wherever I am. I am what is missing. When I walk, I part the air, and always the air moves in to fill the spaces where my body's been. We all have reasons for moving. I move to keep things whole.
You got it memorized. You didn't even look at the page.
Yeah, I have a lot of my poems memorized, but I like to have the page in front of me.
Just in case.
Just in case.
You once said that about sleeping with one eye open, that it was your attempt to prove that you could write poems. You know, not just your poems, but that you could actually do it, you know. And yeah. So do you feel like that this was sort of a gearing up for, you know, it's not your best work? And so I'm wondering, when you read some of those earlier poems, do you edit them in your mind, or do you just let them lie?
I let them lie, and I think some of them may be my best work. I can't, you know, my earlier self is still a part of me, and it would be an act of cruelty to say, Strand, you were no good then, and the poems you wrote were inferior. I worked rather hard on a lot of those poems, and even now I read them and feel that I couldn't do much better. It's not that I'm not sure that we really get better and better. I think that because every poem, when you sit down, every new poem that you sit down to write or to work on is you begin from scratch. You know, it's not, in some ways you don't learn from the previous poem. Excuse me. And that's, it's one of the nice things about poetry. I mean, you feel renewed each time.
You're always starting from scratch.
Yeah. Otherwise you'd get, it would become mechanical. And there wouldn't be much of a kick in doing it.
I want to ask you about how you
excuse me. Yeah.
The idea of how your work, in terms of style. I mean, you've never characterized yourself from a particular school of poetry or style of poetry.
Right.
You know, the New York School or the Beat School.
Right.
You see yourself as what in the middle of all of that? Where do you sort of situate yourself?
Well, you know, I don't really think about where I am. I don't really situate myself. I think of myself as a sort of independent voice. It's true I feel that I belong to any school. I feel my influences are disparate, and you know, they come from all over. A lot of it from European poets, from whom I've learned a great deal. South American poets I've learned from. I've learned from contemporary poets, friends of mine here in the States. I also have been influenced by prose. I think the biggest influence on my work is probably Franz Kafka. At least that's my view. I think for a while it was Wallace Stevens. But the quirkiness, the element in my work that people think of as surreal, yeah, and which I prefer to call fantastic, is really... comes from Kafka.
Do you ever describe your work as formal? Because you once said that poetry is supposed to have this level of grandiosity to it.
Well, I think I was a little wrong when I said that.
Huh.
I think that a poem should try. Well, a poem shouldn't be afraid of. Verbal excess, but that is, we shouldn't be afraid of sounding poetic. Sometimes that's an embarrassment to some, and certainly it's hard to believe someone who speaks in rather florid. It's hard to believe someone who speaks in overly florid terms. On the other hand, it's sometimes those moments of excess that remind us that what we're reading or what we're hearing is poetry after all.
Yeah.
But, you know, you mentioned the word formal. I believe all poems are formal, all poems that have a shape. It doesn't matter whether they're in free verse or whether the lines are short or long. A poem that conforms to some idea of poetry is formal.
Let's take a call. Karen is with us, waiting in Salt Lake. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question. The poem, The Rose, was originally published in The New Yorker, and I don't recall the issue date, and then again published in Man and Camel, but significantly different text. And I am wondering what kinds of considerations do you make after initial publication, then changing something for, I guess, final publication in your volume, Man and Camel?
Oh, I think I know, Karen. But I never thought that the New Yorker, the version I published in the New Yorker, worked quite as well. In fact, I don't remember the draft that I published there. I very often, you know, I almost didn't put it in Man and Camel. It was my editor that insisted I put it in. Something about that poem I never thought worked. But, I mean, I could be wrong. I actually wrote three poems about the rose, and I kind of took parts of each, and I don't know. I'm sort of flailing around in the dark here. I don't really remember quite, you know, what I did or didn't do to that poem.
But you don't regard them as finished at some point. You can.
Well, I usually do, but yeah. that poem created a problem. I'll read it. The rose. The sorrows of the rose were mounting up. Twisted in a field of weeds, the helpless rose felt the breeze of paradise just once, then died. The children cried, "Oh, rose, come back. We love you, rose." Then someone said that soon they'd have another rose. "Come, my darlings, down to the pond. Lean over the edge and look at yourselves, looking up. Now do you see it? Its petals open, rising to the surface, turning into you." "Oh no," they said. "We are what we are, nothing else. How perfect, how ancient, how past repair." Well, as I read it now, it doesn't seem so bad.
Mark Strand, from a conversation we recorded in 2007. He died on Saturday at his daughter's home in Brooklyn. He was 80. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with the former U.S. Poet Laureate Mark Strand, who died on Saturday at the age of 80. We spoke with him back in 2007.
Mark Strand, I wanted to ask you about Edward Hopper, the painter. Yeah. And I wondered if I read an essay that you had written with a book years ago. And I wonder if you ever thought of your poems, the poems that you write, as being like the paintings of Edward Hopper.
Well, I wish they were. I think Hopper's a great painter. I think there is some similarity. The apparent simplicity of means, the sense of an isolated figure, or figure, well, isolated figure, or excuse me, a sense of spaciousness,
yeah.
But space is destiny. There's a temporal character to Hopper's space. That even creates a greater feeling as you look at the paintings of being alone.
Yeah. You know, someone I'd read in a review somewhere that someone figured it's because you and Hopper both locate yourselves, your work, in an internal landscape. Is that right?
I think all artists ultimately do that, and that what appears to be an outside is really the crafty projection of an inside. But, you know, I was responsive to Hopper paintings when I was quite young, when I was, 10, 11 years old.
Really?
When we lived in Croton, New York, I was 11 years old and would take the train into New York to an art class. And you'd go by the tracks would go by these tenements. And you would sort of pass by rooms which people were living, but people you would never know, whose lives were a mystery. And it struck me then, and when I saw Hopper's painting of, there is a painting of sort of entering that tunnel in New York, but all of his paintings have that sense of passing by something that you will never really know.
Early Sunday morning.
Those rooms that are depicted in the city, very much, it's very much the urban experience in New York where you sort of glimpse something for a second and then it's gone. And for an instant you wonder or you picture yourself in that space. And you wonder what your life would be there. And it's, Hopper, meditating on Hopper was a very fruitful experience for me.
After Selected Poems in 1980, you left poetry for a while. I don't know if it was you took a break or you became tired or what was going on there.
Well, I thought I was writing lousy poems. Huh. I thought better not to write poems than to write the things I was writing. So I wrote a lot of prose. I mean, I wrote kids' books, a couple of art monographs, and did a lot of journalism. I wrote for Vogue magazine. I was their photography critic. I wrote a book of short stories. They weren't very good. I kept busy. I just wasn't writing what I wanted to write, which was poetry. And then I read Robert Fitzgerald's translation of the Aeneid, and I was suddenly able to write poetry.
What was it about that got you back on track, do you think?
I don't know, except that I was very moved by the translation, by the poem itself, and I just started writing. I can't explain it. Mm. I mean, there's so much that I can't explain.
Yeah. You described the time writing Dark Harbor as some of the happiest writing in your life.
Oh, I was here in Salt Lake. I was biking every day up City Creek Canyon and coming down and then writing one or two sections of Dark Harbor. I wrote it it's published as our 45 sections, but I actually wrote 83 sections in 3 months. And hardly rewrote at all, and just threw away the sections I didn't think were any good. But to be so productive and to feel no diminishment of one's interest or energy in the project. I consider those very happy days. I just was on fire.
Yeah. I want you to read number 10.
Oh, yeah. It is a dreadful cry that rises up, hoping to be heard, that comes to you as you wake, so your day will be spent in the futile correction of a distant longing. All those voices calling from the depths of elsewhere, from the abyss of an August night, from the misery of a northern winter, from a ship going down in the Baltic, from heartache, from wherever you wish, calling to be saved, and you have no choice but to follow their prompting, saving something of that sound, urging the harsh syllables of disaster into music. You stare out the window, watching the buildup of clouds and the wind whipping the branches of a willow, sending a rain of leaves to the ground. How do you turn pain into its own memorial? How do you write it down, turning it into itself as witnessed through pleasure, so it can be known, even loved, as it lives in what it could not be?
He said this thing to Catherine Coles a few years ago, that pain is filtered in a poem so it becomes finally, in the end, pleasure. And it never happens in a novel. It doesn't happen in any other sort of discipline. It doesn't happen in life, only in poetry.
Yeah. I think because, you know, the music of poetry, the language of poetry, beautifies whatever the experience was and makes it attractive so that one can receive horrible news and receive it with pleasure. That's rather a paradox. If we represented horrible news in a poem and deliberately tried to make it horrible and represented it in an ugly way, no one would read it. I mean, it's not so different from looking at all those crucifixions which represent the agony of Christ on the cross, and yet we think of them as beautiful. We don't think of the agony. We think, oh my God, isn't that wonderful? The way he painted that. How wonderfully moving that is. But we're not saying how wonderfully painful that is.
The poet Mark Strand, from a conversation we recorded in 2007. He died on Saturday in Brooklyn. He was 80. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.